Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to New Books in American Studies. I'm Matthew Johnson, and I'm here today with Stephen Bradley, Associate Professor and Chair in the Department of African American Studies at Loyola Marymount University, to talk about his new book, Upending the Ivory Tower, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Ivy League. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
Yeah, so your first book was about, you know, Black student activism at Columbia University. What led you to go from there to write a broader book about the entire Ivy League?
Well, one of the things I was trying to figure out with the Harlem versus Columbia book, and I think that intrigued me even more, was this idea of why on earth would these Black students who had every opportunity to live, I guess you could say, an upper middle class lifestyle after graduating from an Ivy League school, why would they protest? Why would they make demands of a university or anything like that when they had the privilege of attending a place where most people couldn't step foot? And so I wanted to know about that in a larger way after the Harlem versus Columbia book. But I also wanted to know what was the difference between institutions like Columbia, which sat in the middle of an urban area, and institutions like Dartmouth or Cornell that found themselves in more rural areas, and how is the relationship between the community and the students themselves? What would be the differences when you couldn't call on the community to help you? And that sort of thing. So there were a lot of questions that came up when I was looking, when I was writing the Harlem versus Columbia book that brought me to Upending the Ivory Tower.
You know, I'm wondering what it's like to study the Ivy League, because you, in the beginning of your book, you call yourself an Ivy outsider, right? Because you haven't attended an Ivy League institution like me. I haven't attended an Ivy League institution. I'm definitely an outsider. And you recall this really telling conversation at the beginning of the book with one librarian or archivist in the Ivy League that told you, we don't just let outsiders in. It was really telling. And so I was wondering, you know, what is it like trying to research these places and as an outsider?
Yeah, by and large, you know, everybody was quite hospitable. As I say, some places they treated me like a skinny nephew, and they kept feeding me documents. But at one particular place, and this was fairly early on in the research, I attempted to go into the library, and in not the nicest way, one of these gatekeepers, I guess you could call them, explained that that we don't let outsiders in. To me, I thought that was revelatory in a way, that there is something at these places that's not for mass consumption, that there's an awareness of sorts that some people are insiders and some people are outsiders. And so, thankfully, most people weren't that kind that wouldn't allow me to find out. In terms of the information and that sort of thing, most of these institutions were fairly forthcoming. I think the best part about these institutions is they keep excellent records of themselves. And so I don't know if that happens because they value themselves and they think themselves important, and that people in the future would want to know about them, or if it's something else. But in any event, it the records that they keep are very helpful as long as researchers can get to
them. Sometimes, you know, arrogance and a sense of self-importance is great for historians, isn't it?
right. It helps scholars in the future, right. Definitely.
So I'm wondering if you could, you know, set the scene for some of our listeners of, you know, what was it like for the few Black students who actually gained access to these institutions before the Black campus movement or the Black student movement?
Yeah, I think this was one of the hardest parts to research, because it was it invoked such emotion for me. Early students dealt with a kind of isolation that's unknown to many of us, and so I use various people to speak to this isolation, various figures, and so one of those is J. Saunders Redding, who entered Brown University in 1924 and graduated in 1928. He entered, and perhaps there were four students on campus when he entered the university, two of which graduated while he was there. And then he was left with another Black student. And it was very difficult for him because those two Black students that were left didn't want to appear to only care about Black things. And so they wouldn't be seen together in public. And one of the students that, or the other student, J. Saunders Redding's friend, talked about just the feelings of always being looked at and how he felt like people were always waiting on him to make a bad break. And so to me, this in many ways represented the kind of racial battle fatigue that young people and students had in this earlier period, trying to make it through these Ivy League institutions that were exclusively white and not necessarily welcoming. And so to make a long story short, the friend of J. Saunders Redding ended up dropping out of Brown and committing suicide. Now, I don't make a causal argument about Brown University and the death of that young man, but I will say that many of the people that I looked into for this earlier period talked about how there wasn't a day or a minute or an hour that went by that they weren't reminded of their skin, weren't reminded of their Blackness. And so another person, Harvard alumnus, John Hope Franklin, talked about how he sat in class while his professor was telling darky jokes and things like that. And so these were just very hard times, because people like Du Bois and Charles Hamilton Houston had to figure out a way to make it on these campuses without being necessarily welcomed. And so they did so by banding together. And so that's why you had the establishment of Alpha Phi Alpha at Cornell University and other similar kinds of groups in various places.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of your book is about these students who are trying to address some of those issues. And so my next question is just about the origins of the Black student movement, because one of the things that I kind of struggle with is just kind of explaining the relationship between the Black student movement and the rise of civil rights and Black power, while also trying to acknowledge that this is, you know, the Black student movement is kind of its own thing at the same time. And so I was wondering, you know, how you see the relationship between the Black student movement and civil rights and Black power.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we often forget is that the civil rights movement, the modern civil rights movement as we know it, was largely catalyzed and fueled by the work of students, of young people. And so if you're looking at some of the court cases, they were all about young people and education. If you're looking at some of the most popular activities in the way of freedom rides and sit-ins and that sort of thing, these were all students who were acting off campus to try to confront segregation, confront institutional racism and that sort of thing. Where we see the intersection is when these students or students whose parents or themselves had participated in the movement brought the movement back to campus. And so you'll see this in various ways. Out at Berkeley, you saw students who had participated in the civil rights movement in the forefront of the free speech movement. Students at Columbia University, like Talani Davis, whose parents had participated in the civil rights movement in Virginia, she came back to college energized to participate in the movement and to bring it onto campus. One of the things that happened though is by the mid 1960s, there was a movement on these Ivy League campuses to admit Black students. And so once there was a critical mass, students were able to create an identity for themselves and to start to push back a little bit on the institution's role in civil rights and access. And so these students coming from, you know, from spaces where the civil rights movement was taking hold, where the Black Power movement was taking hold, couldn't ignore any of that when they came to campus. And so so I think that the intersection occurred largely because of the rise of the what in the book I call the larger Black freedom movement, which entailed the civil rights and Black Power movement, the Black arts movement, and the Black campus movement.
And I'm wondering, so clearly one of the things that you outline in the book is activism looks very different on all of these Ivy League campuses. But what are, if you were to look at as a whole, what are some of the common demands that activists made in the Ivy League?
Yeah, and I think that that's an important question. Some common demands. One was, of course, an increase in Black admissions. And I admire this demand because it had very little to do with the students themselves. Of course, they faced mistreatment, but they were calling for increased Black admissions. Largely for students that they may or may not have been able to meet. And so increased Black admissions was one of those things. Work with retention. So students, had to do with things like affinity spaces, where Black students could go to be themselves and not have to worry about, in the book, what I call white gaze, that is people always looking at them, always wondering about them, Black students always having to respond to issues of race and that sort of thing. And so that was another common demand. But then something that I also found to be common was this idea that the institution had to create or be part of Black freedom in some way, fashion, or form. And so at Princeton University, that looked like the institution divesting itself of its $127 million investment in South Africa. But at Columbia University and Penn, that meant that the university shouldn't be expanding into poor Black neighborhoods and that sort of thing. So much of it just depended on space, but there were some commonality between them all.
Yeah, but was there any of those demands that received the most resistance from these Ivy League institutions?
Well, I think some of the demands that were hardest for the institution, or at least took a little bit of time, came in the way of those associated with money, and so in that way, institutions and those who were caretakers of the institutions could sympathize with students who needed to feel welcomed on campus, who wanted to be able to go to class and to make good without feeling so different. They could sympathize with that, but it was the resources that sometimes came slower than other things. And so in a case like Brown University in 1968, students had been in conversation with deans and the president of the institution to increase Black enrollment. Of course, the president of the institution, his name was Raymond Hefner, and the dean of Pembroke College, that's at the time Brown's Women's College, they agreed that there should be more Black admissions, but they didn't necessarily commit to mobilizing resources for that effort. And so that's when students had to walk off of campus, led by the Black women of Pembroke, which is a wonderful story, by the way, led by the Black women of Pembroke, African-American men from Brown University. They walked off and went and took up residence at one of the local Black churches. And eventually the university decided that it would dedicate $1.2 million towards the recruitment effort. The same kind of thing happens out at the University of Pennsylvania when students pressed against the university to stop expanding into West Philadelphia. And that led to some radical white students and Black students taking over College Hall. And what resulted from it was the university's statement concerning a dedication of nearly $10 million to help with housing costs and things like this of people who would be displaced by university expansion. But that took these students pushing. And so that's one of the major kind of assertions of the book, that liberal administrators and even the nicest ones, the ones most sympathetic to the civil rights movement and that sort of thing, they needed to be pushed in order to act. And that's the way of institutions. Institutions don't change by themselves. They have to be nudged.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you were talking about in terms of Philadelphia and some of these spaces, because it gets to the, one of your comments about money, and when money's at stake, just it adds another layer, another obstacle for Black students to get certain reforms. And what's happening in, you know, a place like, I think my favorite chapters are the ones on Philadelphia and the area around Harlem. So what are universities doing in those urban spaces around the university that was really concerning Black students and the Black residents who are living around the university?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I think this space issue is another one of the themes of the book. The space issue is one that can't be understated. These institutions competed with each other. And so when one institution had this many square feet to boast about, another institution wanted as much, and they were competing for the same students. And so each institution wanted to have as many amenities as possible. And so in spaces that are more rural or less urban, you can push out a little bit further. But in spaces like New York City and Manhattan or in West Philadelphia, the city is upon you. And so these institutions took advantage of federal legislation in the way of urban renewal. Some people called it Negro removal. And so this federal funding came along with state funding and municipal funding. As long as these institutions were able to provide kind of a plan, a renewal plan, they pretty much were passed in terms or given permission to expand as much as they needed to. That's because, you know, the federal government thought that these institutions were creating knowledge that was useful to the government and to the United States, and because they thought that these institutions were creating future leaders and that sort of thing. Well, that's where the rub occurs, is who gets to own the space? Residents, oftentimes working class, poor and Black, or the future leaders of America and the world. And so when that occurs, it seems almost hopeless in a sense for the residents, who oftentimes are renters and don't have a great deal of resources to push against, you know, some of the most well-endowed institutions in the nation. And so what they had was the ability to organize. What they had was the zeitgeist of the moment, where Black power called for neighborhoods to to pull together to push against white institutions owning property and pushing into what Black people considered their neighborhoods and that sort of thing. Students wanting to be part of the movement would work in the community. And when they worked in the community, this is white and Black students, when they worked in the community in both Harlem and in West Philadelphia, what they found was residents said, we need help in keeping our homes and providing for ourselves as these institutions push. And that's when you saw some of the major demonstrations of the era take place. And so at Columbia University, of course, students ended up taking over 5 campus buildings in protest of the university's expansion and the university's ties to, you know, to war research. And at Penn, it was a similar kind of situation where hundreds of students ended up participating in a demonstration that led to the university conceding that its expansion had been aggressive and roughshod, and so it slowed expansion for a little while. But yeah, students wanting to be part of that movement were able to coalesce with community members, and I think that that's a beautiful thing because there's oftentimes this what people call a town gown relationship between students and community members. Well, I argue that Black students were able to take advantage of the community, and the community were able to take advantage of Black students who were practicing what I called a Black student power. That is, the ability of these students to use their status to fight on behalf and win victories for the larger Black freedom movement.
Yeah, well, that's a great lead into something else I want to talk about, which is the tactics that these students use. And you mentioned, you know, building takeovers really briefly and the relationship with using the resources in the community. You know, did you see any tactics that were especially effective in pushing these, you know, what you call liberal administrators to actually create some meaningful reforms?
Yeah, well, building takeovers, you know, was a popular tactic, definitely a popular tactic. And so it wasn't new. Out at Berkeley, students had taken over buildings before. In 68 at Howard University, Black students took over campus buildings. And some of the Black students at Columbia and Cornell University had actually been at Howard when students had taken over campus buildings. And so I guess they kind of picked up the tactic there when they came back to their campuses. And so the building takeovers at Columbia, at Cornell, at Princeton, and at Penn were a result of this kind of increased militance that we saw amongst students. Now, one of the things that I have to use as a caveat is these students tried to speak with authorities beforehand and tried to negotiate and things like this. The building takeovers had been part of escalation in some ways. And so that was certainly one technique, but there were other techniques that Black students in the Ivy League used during the 1960s. At Brown University, as I mentioned, they used a technique to walk off campus. They had talked about using the method that Columbia students use, that is the building takeover, but they thought, nah, we don't want to do it like that. And so they said, we will give the institution an opportunity to reflect on what it is without Black students. And so they walked off of campus, and that was just as effective as a building takeover. Just the same, places like Dartmouth College benefited actually from the building takeovers at Columbia University, where the, you know, president of Dartmouth and administrators didn't want to see the kind of tumult that occurred when at Columbia University the president called, you know, 1,000 New York police officers on a campus to remove students, and it became a bloody affair. At Dartmouth, they didn't want that. And so at Dartmouth College, Black students actually negotiated with trustees and were able to get many of the, you know, many of the concessions that other students were able to get at other campuses because of building takeovers and things like that. And so there were different techniques that students used, but by and large, I believe they were successful in creating more access and opportunities for Black students.
We haven't really talked much about Black studies, so I wanted to talk about that for a minute. And maybe one of the most kind of visible and enduring legacies of the movement. And so I was wondering, for Black students at the time, why was that such an important initiative to get into the either a department form or into a center for African American studies or Black studies? Why was that so important for them?
Well. Again, this was one of the most popular demands amongst Black students, not only in the Ivy League, but across the nation, that of Black studies. Part of what's going on here is a push against, and I don't have better words for it, but a push against white supremacy. These students, these Black students, would come to Ivy League institutions where they would study and delve into Western civilization, where they would see the statues on campus that were ancient Greek and Rome of origin, and see the paintings on the wall that were French and whatever it was, and they talk about all of these important figures from Europe. And so there was nothing on these campus that gave the sense that Black people, whether from the continent or in the diaspora in general, had ever contributed anything to the world. And so part of what they wanted to do was to decolonize knowledge. Knowledge in many ways had been the exclusive terrain of whiteness, in a sense, in these Ivy League institutions. And so in 68 and 69 at Yale University, when people like Armstead Robinson and his peers did the really, and I have no better words for this either, the really non-sexy work of creating a unit, an Afro-American studies unit, they did something that I think was revolutionary. And this is why I claim that those who helped to create Black studies in these exclusively white spaces were as much advocates of Black power as Huey Newton or Elaine Brown or any of these people. They were able to change the curriculums of these institutions and add and enhance the curriculums of these institutions that had been around since before there was an official nation. And so to me, that was fascinating. And so it didn't come easy at Yale University. There were those who said, well, if it's that important, why can't we just put it in the regular curriculum of history? And these are people who were advocates and allies, so-called allies of Black people that pushed against a Black studies unit. The students made the argument that had it been that important before to you, you would have done it before. You would have hired Black people before. And so you've lived this way the whole time. And so now that we make this push, there's kind of a resistance. I think other people worried that it would be too much of a cultural thing and not necessarily an academic thing. And many, many people were able to put to bed that thought. At Harvard University, I call the chapter on Harvard, I call it Black Studies the Hard Way. And so it took a good deal of protest and actions to get to the point where the faculty would vote in favor of an Afro-American studies program. And it was fairly unique in the sense that that students would get the opportunity to help hire faculty members, but also to help tenure faculty members. And that was very, very unique in itself. I thought it was a good idea when I was a student, but now that I'm a faculty member, I rethink it all. But yeah, that was a struggle there. But probably in my mind, one of the most interesting interesting struggles to highlight was that at Cornell University, where James Turner, students brought James Turner to campus to establish something called the Africana Studies and Research Center, which was, in my mind, one of the highlights of the period of Black Power. That is, here was the center that reported directly to the provost, where most units reported to the College of Arts and Sciences, or you know, weren't even, you know, units unto themselves, but rather, you know, co-majors and things like that. Well, here was a situation where they tenured their own faculty, where their budget line was appropriate, or was you know, dispersed by way of the provost's office, and so for many people, that was almost kind of a role model, or a model of units. And so that occurred at Cornell University, where much of the attention in terms of Black students and Cornell University had been paid to the Willard Straight Hall takeover, where students took up arms to protect themselves and that sort of thing. And so I make the argument that the establishment of that Africana Studies and Research Center was just as significant in many ways as anything that happened in the Ivy League during the period.
You know, I wanted to talk a bit about one of the other themes of the book, which is just increasing access for Black students and thinking about admissions. And since probably a lot of our listeners have been following the Harvard anti-affirmative action case that's in the trial phase right now, it might be helpful for some of the listeners to hear, you know, what these early affirmative action policies look like. When did they start in the Ivy League, and what they actually look like early on?
Right. Some of the earliest affirmative action policies look like the children of Ivy League students, or the children of Ivy League graduates attending the institution. They look like they had special categories for students who attended certain kinds of high school. So you're talking about St. Paul's and Groton and the Andovers and the various preparatory and day schools that your Judge Kavanaugh's and your Judge Gorsuch's and your Mullers and these kinds of people, those kinds of day schools. So people got special treatment for attending those schools. People got special treatment for their parents having attended these institutions, or for having a certain amount of money. But later affirmative action efforts brought Black students onto campus. And so it was difficult because these institutions, these Ivy League institutions in the 50s and 60s, I would say this, didn't precisely know how to recruit. That because of prestige, because they were known as the top schools in the nation, students knew to apply there. Well, they didn't know how to recruit Black students. And so early on, they tried things. They tried national foundations that brought Black students from urban areas in the South to the North to try to place them in elite white institutions. They tried that. That was slow moving. They tried various other things, programs like the foundation year at Dartmouth College, where they brought students to campus for a year to remediate. And they looked to urban students. They went to the west side of Chicago and recruited out of a street gang called the Vice Lords. And so they, you know, brought students to campus that way. And so part of what they needed, though, was help from Black people themselves. And that's where students came in. Students oftentimes in the earlier parts were doing the recruiting of other Black students. And so that's significant in itself because they weren't necessarily paid to do so. That was somebody's job, but they were doing that as part of this effort. But also, students were demanding admissions officers, Black admissions officers that would help with the effort. In terms of hiring and that sort of thing, as affirmative action became became more policy, students here again helped the university by pushing for these Black studies programs, which in essence helped to boost the number of Black professors on campus. And so these were the techniques used to bring Black people onto campus, and there was pushback. Some of these day schools were actually upset when admissions officers started looking beyond the prep schools and the day schools to recruit Black students. And so they felt as though these prep schools and day schools felt as though they were being discriminated against because students from outside of that network were being admitted at higher rates. Some of that has to do with you know, with things like Pell Grants and, you know, and loans and other kinds of scholarships and things like that. But some of it had to do with this idea that finally people started to realize that smart Black students existed outside of those prep schools and day schools, and that you had to go get them.
We've talked a lot of, so far about some of the kind of enduring legacies of the movement. I'm wondering, throughout your research, did you start to see some signs of some enduring failures of the movement, just things that really important things that Black students lost, or things that universities have initial victories that universities have rolled back more recently?
Yeah, I think one of the things that was lost, and the scholar activist Vincent Harding spoke to this, was when these institutions started opening up to Black students, faculty, and staff, and administrators, there was what could be described as a bit of a brain drain from historically Black colleges and universities. And so some of the, you know, some of the scholars that were doing really well were picked up by the Ivy League. Say, for instance, Charles Hamilton, who was co-author of the book Black Power, in perfect Ivy fashion, Columbia University, said, if you, okay, you want Black Power and you want Black Studies, then we'll get Mr. Black Power, Charles Hamilton, to come and teach at the institution. Well, he had taught it at Roosevelt College in Chicago, which was predominantly Black and very urban. And those students, they needed him as much as any other students. And so there's that part of it. But also, one of the things that I frequently tell young people is it's difficult. It's very difficult to get things. It's difficult to get higher Black admissions. It's difficult to get things like a Black cultural center and those sorts of things. But it's much more difficult to keep those things. And so what we've seen is rollbacks, in a sense, of Black admissions. Part of that because of the larger push against affirmative action, the larger push against what the right has called race-based admissions, and that sort of thing. Schools becoming skittish about issues of what they're calling diversity because of fear of litigation and that sort of thing. Those are some of the things that are problematic for students today. I think in terms of other things that may have been lost or that haven't worked out so well, one of those things has to do with the support of Black studies. Black studies on these campuses have always had to be defended in a way. Some of the programs struggled for a while, but because of resources, because of students' ability to continue protesting, some of these some of these programs have been able to bolster themselves. But there were times when they struggled along with other ethnic studies programs.
Yeah, well, I'd love to end just by thinking about the recent activism, Black student activism on some of the Ivy League campuses. Do you have any, you know, given the research that you've done here in the 1960s and 1970s, do you have any pieces of advice for those students who are trying to challenge their institutions right now?
Yeah, one is of course, they should acquaint themselves with the history. And so, as is always the case, there is nothing new under the sun. And so, in many ways, these students can learn a lot from the actions of earlier students. I think that's one part of it. The second part of it is like those students from previous periods, including that period before World War II, if the campaigns are about the students themselves and how they feel at this very moment, they'll likely fail. But if the campaigns are about access and success for students in the future, and for freedom for Black people in the future, then I think they'll be more successful. I think the other things to keep track of is everybody loves diversity, but nobody wants to pay for diversity. And so I think the students themselves should beware of things like budgets and timelines and that sort of thing. That was one of the things that students did very well in that period after World War II is they were able to hold their institutions accountable. At Brown University, Black students wouldn't come back on a campus until the university made a commitment of a certain amount of funding. The same is true with students who took over other buildings throughout the Ivy League. And so that commitment of funding, that commitment of timelines is important. And then finally, is students today oftentimes feel as though they don't belong and that sort of thing. When talking with one student who attended Dartmouth College, he had said that he was always aware that he was intelligent, that he was always aware that he was smart. These students need to realize that they're intelligent and smart and they deserve to be there. And that getting to the table or being able to be around a network of powerful elite people is not nearly enough, not nearly enough. And so if they are really the caretakers of the future, then they have to take care of the idea of justice and freedom, particularly for Black people.
Well, great advice. Stephen Bradley, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Matt.
The book is Upending the Ivory Tower. Thank you for listening.